Hello and welcome to Cancer Care Connect Workshop. At this time, all participants are in the listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Shanitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Caring for Your Bones When You Have Multiple Myeloma. And this could not be a more timely subject. It's so important. I know many of you, we live in all different, of course, areas in terms of weather and all weather conditions, but I'm sure that many of you have concerns about just how best to care for your bones, and you're going to hear lots of information today to help you with those issues and concerns. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it's because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you. We have on the call today over 724 participants, and you come from all different regions of the United States, so all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Brazil, Canada, India, Korea, Pakistan, Puerto Rico, United Arab Emirates, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a global call. We realize that this technology allows us to reach each other so easily. Today's program is supported by an educational donation provided by Amgen and Friends of Cancer Care, and we thank them for their support to make this program possible. Also, you received information from Cancer Care, and there is an evaluation form. I would ask you to please complete that evaluation form at the end of today's program. You know, your feedback is really so critically important to us as we plan future programs. Indeed, the topic for today's program was one that many of you had requested that we offer. So take a moment. You know, it's the beginning of a new year. Fill out the evaluation form. Tell us what you'd like us to offer, your recommended subjects and topics for the future, and we'll try very hard to implement them over this next year. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. William Bensinger. Dr. Bensinger is professor of medicine, University of Washington. He's also director, autologous stem cell transplant program, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. Dr. Bensinger is going to focus on the overview of multiple myeloma, its effect on your bones, treatment options for multiple myeloma, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's now my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Bensinger.
Thank you, Carolyn. Multiple myeloma is a cancer of the bone marrow. It's specifically a cancer involving plasma cells, and these are normal antibody-producing cells that reside in our bone marrow. These abnormal plasma cells are referred to as myeloma cells, and they grow in an uncontrolled fashion and fill up the bone marrow. At the same time, they produce large amounts of proteins, which we call monoclonal proteins, that can appear in the blood or urine. But the cells themselves lead to anemia, which is low red blood cells, kidney problems, and bone disease, which is probably the most common feature of the disease. The cause of multiple myeloma is not known, but increasingly we've observed that genetic alterations in plasma cells lead to the development of the disease. It's not a super common disease. There's about 20,000 new cases in the U.S. Each year. That's about 1% of all cancers. And there are currently about 55,000 to 60,000 people with myeloma in the U.S. at any one time. It's a disease of older people. The median age is about 68 to 70. And this is important because some treatments, such as stem cell transplant, are generally limited to patients 70 years of age or younger. The disease is treatable with multiple chemotherapies, but it's very difficult to actually cure. However, new drugs and the use of stem cell transplant has substantially improved the survival over the last couple of years. Typically, patients may present with bone pain or fatigue or weight loss, or they may have frequent infections because they actually have low levels of normal antibodies. But up to 20% of patients will have no symptoms at diagnosis. Now, the myeloma cells, because plasma cells are, because they derive from plasma cells, frequently are involved in the bone disease. They secrete cytokines, and these are small molecules that act like hormones. And the myeloma cells can actually stimulate cells to become what we call osteoclasts, which are cells that break down bone. At the same time, they interact with your bone marrow stroma, which are supporting cells in the bone marrow. And these cells, in turn, secrete other hormones that are cytokines that inhibit osteoblasts, which are cells that build up new bone. And so there is more cells that break down bone than cells that build up bone. And this leads to the bone problems in myeloma. Bone pain is a common feature from pathological fractures or compression fractures or generalized loss of calcium we call osteopenia. In severe cases, patients can develop hypercalcemia from rapid bone breakdown. And Dr. Raji is going to talk in great detail about this. But these bone problems affect the quality of life and can impact the survival of patients with multiple myeloma. Now, one of the critical questions is when to start treatment. In patients that are asymptomatic or have only very mild anemia or just a little bit of osteoporosis don't necessarily need treatment right away. We usually treat patients that have clear bone damage from the disease or significant anemia or high calcium levels, frequent infections, or who are developing kidney damage that we can directly attribute to the myeloma. And the usual treatments involve combinations of drugs. And some of the drug combinations now, patients can respond 100% of the time. Complete response rates generally run about 20 to 40%. And stem cell transplant continues to be an important component of this therapy. And I think increasingly the disease is becoming easier to treat, but complete eradication or cure of the disease remains still a somewhat elusive goal. Now, when we talk about treatment response, we talk about remissions or a complete response, which means that we're unable to detect any of the abnormal proteins in the blood or urine, and the plasma cells in the bone marrow are at their normal level, about 5% or less, and that there aren't any new or progressive bone problems that develop. As far as drugs, we have about five classes of drugs that are currently used. Corticosteroids are a commonly used form of therapy, and this includes drugs like prednisone and dexamethasone. Alkylators are similarly common, cyclophosphamide, melphalan, and more recently bendamustine are drugs among these classes. Anthracyclines such as doxorubicin or a long-acting form we call pegylated doxorubicin are frequently used. And then more recently, newer drugs, the immunomodulatory drugs, of which we have thalidomide and lenalidomide, are being used very commonly, and proteasome inhibitors, of which the drug bortezomib is the first in class. And I think we're still learning about sequencing of therapies and what drug or drug combinations are necessary for initial therapy. If a patient is transplant eligible, we generally sequence the transplant after several cycles of initial therapy. In some cases, patients or doctors may choose to store the stem cells and delay transplant to a later date. We're frequently involved in studies of maintenance as a way to maintain response or remission in patients, and there are many, many trials that are using maintenance therapies at this time. And then for relapse disease, we have lots of new drugs that are under investigation. And Dr. Raji is going to talk about that in more detail. Now, the combinations that are frequently used include bortezomib and dexamethasone with either thalidomide or lenalidomide, or just two drugs such as bortezomib dexamethasone or lenalidomid dexamethasone. Another commonly used combination is cyclophosphamide with bortezomib and dex. If a patient is not considered a transplant candidate, they may include a combination of melphalan and prednisone with either thalidomide or lenalidomide or bortezomib. And lenalidomide dex can also be used in non-transplant patients as well. Now, high-dose therapy involves very high doses of the drug melphalan with the use of the patient's own stem cells for support. And this is a commonly used therapy because it results in higher rates of remission than conventional therapy. It prolongs the disease-free interval, and in some but not all studies, improves survival. It is considered a standard of care for eligible patients, and it's generally well tolerated in patients up to the age of 70. There are some trials that have demonstrated that two transplants, so-called tandem transplants, may be better than one. Another type of transplant that can be used is an allogeneic transplant from a donor, but these involve higher toxicity and higher mortality and unique complications such as graft versus host disease. They may provide some anti-tumor effects because of this immunologic effect of the graft, but they're still considered investigational for most patients. Now, in terms of who is a transplant candidate, generally patients have to have a good performance status with decent lung, liver, and heart function. They can be transplanted at almost any phase of the disease, either responsive or relapsed disease. Even refractory patients in some trials have shown that they can benefit from a transplant. Generally, we take patients under the age of 70, but it is possible to do these transplants in older patients if they have a good performance status. Patients who've received melphalan previously or drugs like BCNU or extensive radiation to the spine or pelvis may not be as good a candidate because it may be difficult to collect stem cells from such patients. Now, in terms of your treatment, it's best if you can find a doctor who specializes in treating people with myeloma. These are usually so-called hematology oncologists or hematologists. That's often not possible if you live in a small or rural area, but then it may be possible to have your doctor partner with a myeloma specialist at a distant center who can work with him and help in terms of treatment design. If you need a specialist, I believe the cancer care can help you find specialists in your area. And it's obviously important to check your health insurance to make sure that you've got coverage for a physician in another place. In terms of working with your doctors, your doctor and you should work as a team, along with the nurses that take care of you, the pharmacists who's dispensing the drug, and maybe other specialists who may provide your care, such as a bone specialist if you have problems with a bone fracture. You should discuss very openly your level of involvement, how involved you want to be in your care, and don't be afraid to ask questions, any kind of questions, and that certainly demonstrates to your team that you are interested in your care. And it's very important to keep your team members apprised of how you're feeling. For example, some of the drugs may cause numbness or tingling in your hands or feet, and if you're developing early signs and symptoms, it's important that you talk to them about this because there are ways of dealing with that. And really just make your team aware of how you want to be cared for. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Carolyn.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Benson, for just a wonderful overview and of the treatments of multiple myeloma, lots of different treatments, and lots of hope for people, different things that can be done. And thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Rajay Napur. Dr. Rajay is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. She is Director, Center for Multiple Myeloma, Division of Hematology and Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Rajay is going to cover reducing complications of bone disease, managing bone pain and discomfort, clinical trials, and also going to address the issues of quality of life concerns. And I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Rajay.
Thank you, Carolyn. Dr. Benzinger has given you all an excellent overview of myeloma, and as you've just heard, the use of these new drugs have resulted in the transformation of myeloma into a chronic disease. And we're very excited specifically with the research now with the available novel targeted treatments. What I will do in the next few minutes is talk to you a little bit about clinical trials, some of the promising new drugs on the horizon, talk to you about symptom and pain management, and finally focus on quality of life issues pertaining to your myeloma. I will specifically also focus on bone disease and the things you can do to try and help with the care of your bones. As mentioned earlier, we're very excited about some of the drugs Dr. Benzinger has already alluded to. We have 6 FDA-approved drug combinations now for the treatment of myeloma, and this expedited approval process has been largely because of your willingness in participating in some of the clinical trials, which we've been able to accomplish in a very timely fashion. In this past year, the focus has now shifted on combining some of these drugs, which Dr. Benzinger has already mentioned. Specifically, we're now learning to combine the IMiDs with the proteasome inhibitors, such as combining bortezomib with lenalidomide, and also looking to combine additional agents. And the goal here is largely transforming this very chronic disease and working at least towards the elusive cure, which Dr. Benzinger has mentioned. We've seen excellent efficacy and tolerability with some of these combinations. We now know that we can incorporate these combinations in our transplant strategies. But even more exciting than these combinations is some of the newer drugs which we've been testing in our laboratories as well as in very early clinical trials. These drugs essentially include new proteasome inhibitors, HDAC inhibitors, certain classes of drugs called mTOR inhibitors, CDK inhibitors, and I'll go over some of these in the next few minutes. Novel single agents of great promise include a new proteasome inhibitor called carfilzomib. It has shown remarkable activity in treating patients with myeloma when the disease has come back again, and it's even active in patients who have been previously treated by the proteasome inhibitor bortezomib. So carfilzomib seems to be working in people who've relapsed even after bortezomib, so we're very excited about this drug. Another exciting agent is a new IMiD. So we had thalidomide and lenalidomide, which a lot of you have probably received. But the newest agent now on the block is a drug called pomalidomide. This is the newest IMiD after thalidomide and Revlimid, and it has shown very potent activity in people who actually previously received either thalidomide or lenalidomide. We're also looking at several combination strategies with novel agents. To this end, we have combined HDAC inhibitors such as panobinostat and vorinostat. These have been combined with the proteasome inhibitor bortezomib, and this is based on laboratory studies showing that these drugs target different targets as well as different cellular pathways, and when combined, they actually show potent synergism. Other combinations born out of our laboratory studies include combining drugs like the mTOR inhibitor RAD011 with lenalidomide, again showing very promising data. Other combinations include CNTO-328, which is an anti-IL-6 antibody, is being combined with bortezomib. There are another class of antibodies which we're quite excited about, one of them being LY2127399. This is directed against BAFF, which is a growth factor for your myeloma cells or plasma cells. It's the B-cell activating factor. There's another antibody called elotuzumab, and elotuzumab is directed against a protein called CS1, which is essentially present on everybody's myeloma cells. So combination with elotuzumab with lenalidomide has shown very promising results. Ultimately, I think it's going to be possible for us in the laboratory at least to carry out gene and protein expression profiling studies and come up with treatment strategies and combinations which are specific to patients and specific to specific patient myeloma. Now, because of the rapid evolution in available therapies, I would encourage all of you to seek out clinical trials, communicate with your healthcare providers, and see what is available at your center or a center which is close by. And as Dr. Benzinger had mentioned earlier, partner with a myeloma expert so that you know that you're getting the best available treatment for your myeloma. Although these novel agents are very effective and are generally well tolerated, it is important that you understand some of the side effects and, again, communicate these to your healthcare providers so that appropriate measures can be taken to mitigate some of the side effects which are seen with these drugs. For example, if you're on agents like thalidomide and lenalidomide, these drugs tend to predispose patients to blood clots. Depending on what other associated chemotherapeutic agents you're on or whether or not you have other associated risk factors, we would recommend using either aspirin or blood thinners such as low molecular weight heparin or Coumadin so as to prevent issues such as thrombosis. Other issues around lenalidomide include decrease in blood counts, and therefore checking blood counts and adjusting lenalidomide doses are important. Bortezomib, as Dr. Benzinger has already mentioned, can cause neuropathy, which results in pain and loss of sensation and tingling and numbness. It's important that you communicate this again to your nurses, your physicians, so that one can then take steps to decrease the doses of bortezomib so that you don't end up with toxicities which impact quality of life. Symptomatic treatment with agents such as gabapentin and newer ones such as Cymbalta and Lyrica are useful adjuncts to the treatment of neuropathy. We do recommend certain vitamin supplements, specifically B vitamin supplements, in the setting of patients being on drugs such as bortezomib. Neuropathy is also common with agents such as thalidomide, but not seen or rarely seen with drugs such as lenalidomide. Finally, keeping up with physical therapy and exercise helps decrease problems not only associated with neuropathy, but also is of tremendous benefit to bone disease. Symptoms from myeloma are largely because of either anemia, which results in fatigue, or from the bone disease, and treating the underlying multiple myeloma actually helps all of this. Other strategies specifically directed towards your bones include the use of bone-strengthening agents such as bisphosphonates. And what we typically use in myeloma patients is an intravenous bisphosphonate. It could be either pomidronate, also known as Iridia, or zoledronic acid, also known as Zometa. And this is recommended for anybody with multiple myeloma and related bone disease. These bone-strengthening agents have proven in randomized clinical trials to decrease the incidence of complications, which if left untreated, patients with myeloma can present with bony pains, fractures, might need radiation, etc. Most recently, there's been a large randomized trial which came out of the United Kingdom, which has demonstrated a benefit in terms of overall survival of patients with multiple myeloma who were being treated with the intravenous treatment zoledronic acid or Zometa. There are other local measures which can be taken for the treatment of your bone disease, specifically if you end up with vertebral compression fractures, and these include vertebral augmentation procedures such as vertebroplasty and kyphoplasty. They can certainly help decrease painful compression fractures or symptomatically improve the pain caused by these compression fractures. In certain situations, we do tend to use radiation. We like minimizing the use of radiation because it can have toxicities on the bone marrow. But for certain situations where pain is an issue, one does tend to use radiation. Other procedures which sometimes are used for bone disease include surgical fixation, specifically if there's a risk of fracture of a specific bone. Excitingly, we have several novel agents which are currently under preclinical evaluation in the laboratory. These are anabolic agents. These are bone-forming agents, which to date have not been used in myeloma. But we are very excited about some of these, one of them being called ACE-011. And this is soon going to be a part of a clinical trial in combination with lenalidomide, with the goal here being not just treating bone disease, but hopefully improving bone health by causing bone formation. Now, given the complexity of both the symptoms and the available therapies for myeloma, it's important that you partner with your healthcare team and communicate all your symptoms and concerns so as to allow you and your healthcare team to help manage your myeloma in the best possible way. Participating in the available clinical trials will help inform all of us and help improve the outcomes for all patients now and in the future. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Carolyn. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rajay, for just a very informative and very comprehensive presentation. I know there'll be many questions for Dr. Rajay during the Q&A. Thank you for that very informative presentation. Our next speaker is Dr. Douglas Peterson. Dr. Peterson is Professor of Oral Medicine, Chair of Program in Head and Neck Cancer and Oral Oncology, NAIC Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of Connecticut Health Center. And Dr. Peterson is going to address dental care before and during treatment. Dr. Peterson?
Thank you, Carolyn. It's my privilege to be part of our discussion today. And I'd like to begin by describing an overall context in the relation to dental care in the myeloma patient. It's important to realize that not all cancers and cancer treatments, including treatments for myeloma, cause mouth problems. And some of these mouth problems could be jawbone problems, but it's important to realize that not all of the treatments do cause jaw problems. And secondly, there are important and excellent resources available to patients and families, including those provided through cancer care. And as we've already heard from our previous excellent speakers, it's very important to establish and foster a partnership between the patient and the family and the cancer care team in order to develop very clear understandings, make sure all the questions are answered, and so that optimal treatment can be given. And when this is all put together, this approach can lead often to quite positive results, including a very good quality of life for many years to come. Now, in relation to multiple myeloma and dental issues specifically, it's worth noting that multiple myeloma in some patients can occur in the lower jawbones of some patients. For example, it can sometimes cause a jawbone pain that seems like a toothache or a gum infection, and this may cause the patient to go to the dentist. And the dentist is well trained to evaluate these symptoms and, where appropriate, refer to the physician when multiple myeloma is suspected. And if myeloma is the diagnosis, as we've already heard from Drs. Benziger and Raji, the disease can be very responsive to today's state-of-the-art cancer treatments. Now, some of the actual cancer treatments that we've heard about today can cause temporary changes in the mouth, including mouth sores or mucositis. Now, these kinds of problems are not jawbone problems per se, so I'll defer on detailed discussion at this point. If the lesions such as mucositis do occur, there are some very good approaches to reduce the soreness and help the mouth sores heal. We can certainly discuss any of these issues during our question and answer session if that would be helpful. I'd like now to spend the next few minutes related to a specific condition of the upper and lower jaw called osteonecrosis of the jaw, or ONJ. Now, this is a condition that can occur in some patients receiving bisphosphonates. It's very important to realize that it does not occur in most patients receiving bisphosphonates. In fact, approximately up to 10% of patients receiving long-term bisphosphonates may develop this problem. So it is important to realize that the bisphosphonates are very, very important and effective drugs, and ONJ occurs in a relatively small percentage of those patients. Now, ONJ has also been seen in association with some newer drugs that are being used to treat bone disease in cancer patients, but since the majority of experience to date involves bisphosphonates, I'll focus on that group of medications. So with this perspective and coupling it with the excellent presentations by my medical colleagues, Drs. Benziger and Raji, let me now turn to dental care in relation to myeloma treatment. It's very important to realize that prevention of jawbone problems can be quite possible if the collaboration between the physician and the dentist and the patient is in place. And again, this speaks to the very important communication that we've already heard about of the healthcare team with the patient and the family. And by referring the patient before the cancer treatment starts for myeloma or before the bisphosphonate treatment actually begins, the dentist is well trained to prioritize what kinds of dental treatment may be needed and accomplish that treatment to minimize any future risks of the jawbone in relation to myeloma management. Now, most cases of ONJ have been associated with the use of what we call nitrogen-containing bisphosphonates, such as the zoledronic acid or the pimidronate that Dr. Raji mentioned before. And it appears that patients with mouth disease or dental disease, such as advanced gum disease, have increased risk for ONJ when they're receiving these types of drugs. However, cases of ONJ have been reported with the use of many different types of bisphosphonates as well. The current literature indicates that most of the ONJ cases occur in patients receiving intravenous bisphosphonates as opposed to orally administered bisphosphonates. And the risk for ONJ in the patient with dental disease appears to become realized beginning approximately 1 year after having been on the medication by intravenous infusion. And the risk for ONJ tends to increase over the years as the bisphosphonate is used. Now, patients receiving oral bisphosphonates can also develop ONJ, although it's less frequent. And it appears, although this is being continually researched, that the risk begins around 3 years after the patient has begun the oral bisphosphonates. Now, in addition to the IV bisphosphonates and the pre-existing dental disease, such as the gum disease I mentioned, there are other risk factors for ONJ, including older age, long-term use of steroids, diabetes, smoking, and multiple myeloma itself, which can cause bone changes. However, more research is needed in order to better understand these risks for ONJ as well as ways to treat them. And that really leads me to reemphasize the very important point that Dr. Raji mentioned related to clinical trials. And I, too, would advocate for your consideration of participating in clinical trials so that we can collectively work together to not only improve current care of patients with multiple myeloma, but future patients as well. Now, despite very careful attention and communication and preparation of the mouth before the patient starts the myeloma treatment or starts the bisphosphonate treatment, ONJ can occur, as we've already heard, again, in a relatively small percentage. It is important to realize that ONJ can be treated. It may take weeks, sometimes months, for the treatment to really, really take hold. But it is essential that the discussion with your healthcare team, with your oncology team, and with the dentist take place so that a very good decision related to the benefits of continuing with bisphosphonates versus possibly discontinuing the bisphosphonates even temporarily for a few weeks or months be considered. But again, overall, the benefits of the bisphosphonates far outweigh any consideration of discontinuing the drug. And so from the dental side, we'll typically manage the ONJ from a relatively conservative standpoint while keeping the patient on the bisphosphonate. We'll use antibiotics. We'll use topical rinses to help with the wound. We'll use gentle treatment of the lesion if possible, if it's needed, and work with you to maintain things to be very clean in your mouth. All of that should accomplish good recovery of the ONJ. So I'd like to summarize where we started just a few minutes ago, that not all cancer and cancer treatments cause mouth problems either during or after the cancer therapy, and this is also the case with myeloma. There are excellent resources through Cancer Care and other organizations for patients and their families, and I'd really urge you to take full advantage of those excellent resources. And this partnership that we've talked about today with the patient and the family and the caregivers, the healthcare team as well, often leads to excellent results for the patient, including excellent quality of life for many years to come. With that, I'll turn the podium back to Carolyn.
Thank you very much, Dr. Peterson, for a wonderful presentation and most informative. So thank you, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Our next speaker is Richard Dickens. Rick is an oncology social worker. He's our blood cancers program coordinator, mind, body, spirit project coordinator at Cancer Care. And Rick is going to review with you some of the services that you can access from Cancer Care. Rick?
Thank you, Carolyn. I appreciate the educational and expert advice of Drs. Rajay, Peterson, and Bensinger. It's always a pleasure hearing your updates. For multiple myeloma patients and families, there are numerous issues related to treatment which impact your lives. Periods between treatment often create anticipatory anxiety and uncertainty. Concerns about treatment, insurance, jobs, or who will help loved ones are common questions as well. When treatment becomes necessary, there are additional issues of self-esteem due to treatment side effects as well as treatment-related fatigue, which can impact normal activities of daily living. At some point, the whole cancer process will become familiar to you, and you will develop what is often called a new normal. That is why building relationships with your healthcare team, which has been a common theme in today's presentation, are so important. For many, it is helpful to think of this relationship as a partnership or collaboration. Your oncology team are experts in your cancer and treatment, but you are the expert of your body and your life. And for that reason, mutual respect can go a long way to foster the best supportive care. Here are some tips to guide you along this process. Do your research. The Internet is a good place to start, but helpful organizations such as Cancer Care can guide you through this process. Becoming a knowledgeable consumer will give you a sense of control and make you an active member in your treatment decisions. Take your time. Sometimes saying, I need a day to think about this, can give you an opportunity to catch your breath and get feedback from loved ones and other resources. And finally, speak up. Don't be afraid to bring up any topic of concern to your healthcare team. Remember, your doctor and oncology team can't treat a problem if you don't make them aware of it. Accepting that changes are normal during treatment can go a long way toward nurturing your body and spirit. Changes brought on by treatment can affect sexual and body functions and challenge most people's self-image, eliciting feelings of sadness, anger, fear, and frustration. At the same time, what is happening to the patient can make family and friends feel helpless, scared, and sad as well. During these times, it is often helpful to seek the help of a social worker or other healthcare professional. At Cancer Care, we have over 40 oncology social workers who inform people of resources and strategies for finding help. We assist those most needy with financial grants and provide counseling, as well as run regional face-to-face groups and national telephone and online support groups for patients and loved ones. These groups provide role models, emotional support, coping strategies, and validation that you're not alone in what you feel. To many, support groups and social supports go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenge of cancer, and daunting as they are, with help, they're never impossible. Thank you, and I wish you all the best in your care and treatment.
Thank you very much, Rick, just for your just compassionate presentation and just for being on this call. Thank you. And now we do have time for questions. We have actually lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Trinitha to bring all of our speakers on board and explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, and we're going to take as many of your questions as possible. If we do not get your question today, please call Cancer Care, and we will be happy to take your questions after the call. Trinitha?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question is from Henry S. Your question, please.
Yes, I would like one of the doctors, if they could, to talk a little bit about if osteosclerotic myeloma without having POM syndrome or no neuropathy. Could one of the doctors talk about that briefly, or and what kind of special treatment might be needed for that?
Thank you, Henry, for that question. And Dr. Bensinger, would you be able to address that?
Well, it's a very rare form of myeloma that can present. Typically, though, I think the treatment is very similar to standard patients with multiple myeloma. They get unusual bone problems that don't occur with other patients with myeloma. I really can't say a whole lot extra about it. I'm not sure what it is, the question, what he's looking for.
And Dr. Rache, did you want to add anything?
I would agree with Dr. Benzinger completely. This osteosclerotic myeloma is an extremely rare form of myeloma. It happens in less than 1 out of 100 people. But when it does occur, and if you're symptomatic from the osteosclerotic myeloma, we really don't change how we treat the myeloma. The underlying myeloma should be treated the way any osteolytic myeloma would be treated. And we would, in addition to treating the myeloma, we would continue to treat the bone disease as well. So there's no real difference. It's just that it's a little rare to present as sclerotic bone lesions as opposed to lytic lesions, which is the common way of myeloma presenting.
Henry's question makes me think about the fact that when there's something unusual or rare about one's cancer, we often recommend that one would perhaps get a consultation at one of the designated comprehensive cancer centers. Dr. Benzinger, Dr. Rache, or Dr. Peterson, would you want to comment on that, just that whole concept of sometimes something, and it could be other people on the call, have some rare presentation, and then it may be that where would they go in terms of getting their best care?
Well, I think it's especially important to see a specialist if you have something out of the ordinary, because they're certainly more likely to have seen and dealt with this problem than a physician, a local physician who may only see one or two patients with myeloma a year.
And the other point which Henry brought up, Carolyn, is also very important. He mentioned when he talked about his osteosclerotic myeloma, the issue with no neuropathy and no evidence of POM syndrome. So the reason Henry brought that up is osteosclerotic myeloma is more common with people who present with POM. So even if that was not at the presentation, that's something which needs to be constantly looked for going forward. So agree completely, should be seen in a specialist center and at least should get a second opinion from some place where they see more volume.
Excellent. Thank you. Henry, I hope that's helpful to you, and thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Bob V. Your question, please.
This is a question for Dr. Peterson. Have you run into situations where within the teeth the odontoblasts and odontoclasts get out of balance and hollow out the tooth, sort of like the osteoblasts and osteoclasts? And if so, what's the proper treatment and what's the prevention for the problem?
Thank you for that question. Dr. Peterson?
Thank you. It isn't the condition that Bob describes is not classically encountered in myeloma. We do see problems of the dental pulp, which is the alive part of the tooth, and that includes the blood supply and the nerves and some of the tissues that help shape the inside of the tooth. And there can be some what we call resorptive conditions where the osteoclast can actually, and some of the cells within the dental pulp can actually cause internal resorption of the hard part of the tooth. The treatment would typically, following diagnosis, involve ideally some kind of root canal therapy to eliminate the diseased part of the tooth. But it would require very, very careful diagnosis by the dental team and then further discussion with the patient.
Well, shall we say something about the dental team when something, because of the complexity of the care, also seeking dentists who are actually part of a team as you are at a comprehensive center. Could you comment on that a bit?
Yes, I think it ties nicely to the previous question as well, Carolyn, and that's that in the more comprehensive centers, there tends to be ready access to any number of generalists and specialists. And one of the themes we've had today is really the multi-professional, really the team approach that is needed in many of these cases, and that includes the oncology team, the oncology nursing team, the social work team, the dental team, just to name four. And in the larger settings, such as a comprehensive cancer center, access to those teams is really part and parcel of the process. I just make one other brief comment. Dr. Bensinger made the excellent point earlier that if this isn't accessible because of distance or other, then communicating with a cancer team at a comprehensive cancer center can often help the physician and his or her team in the community through some of these more complex issues. So the second theme we've heard about that we'd emphasize is the communication.
And that's really such an important point because, you know, I know, well, for today's program, for example, the whole part of the whole Northeast and probably other parts of the country too have had some really unusual weather conditions, a lot of snow actually, and you know, we now have the communication capacity. We, of course, phones have been around for a very long time, but many of the comprehensive centers do have calls. You can actually call in their 800 numbers. You can call the National Cancer Institute, their 1-800 for cancer number. You can call them, and actually they can help to direct you to places where you can actually call and speak to people, even if you can't travel to those places. So I think that's really very important to know that these resources are really more at your fingertips than we sometimes think, and also, you know, working with a comprehensive center, it can be very helpful. Great questions. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Bob G. Your question, please.
What about vitamin D supplements?
Excellent question. Dr. Ajay?
So vitamin D supplementation, Bob, is recommended. If you are on a bisphosphonate, we in fact recommend calcium with vitamin D supplementation. Typically, the vitamin D supplementation is about 800 international units. And, you know, the one thing which oncologists don't typically check for is vitamin D levels in people. It's important to check that. And if you're above 30, it's good. Getting close to above 50 or around 50 is what would be recommended, but certainly above 30 should be the goal. So yes, should be on vitamin D supplementation, specifically if you're on a bisphosphonate.
Excellent. These are great questions. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Mary W. Your question, please.
Thank you. This is addressed to everyone on the panel. How long is it safe to stay on IV bisphosphonates? And if one does have a root canal issue, is it all right to just have the tooth extracted without an implant after?
Okay, excellent question. I think that probably is a question that many people on the call have or are thinking about. Dr. Ajay, do you want to start? And then...
Sure. So that's an excellent question, Mary, and we really don't necessarily have all of the answers, but we are certainly looking into this. As Dr. Peterson had pointed out in his discussion, you know, the risk of developing problems such as ONJ happen at around year 3 after exposure. Having said that, you know, we've seen ONJ even earlier on, but that's kind of the average. Because of that, we do believe, although bisphosphonates are great drugs, we do believe that we need to use them a little more carefully. So we are actually doing studies as we speak where we have reduced the frequency of how often we give patients bisphosphonates so that we've just about finished completing a study. It's called the ZMARC study where we've given patients the bisphosphonate every 3 months with the goal of minimizing exposure to drugs such as bisphosphonates, and at the same time you're getting the benefit from the bisphosphonate but mitigating side effects such as ONJ. So, you know, if you're in a good remission from your myeloma, although there's no data to support alternate dosing, that data will soon come, and at least the recommendations based on ASCO guidelines is you should have a discussion with your oncologist to continue bisphosphonate use for at least 2 years. Beyond the 2-year time point, if your disease is in remission, it is, and you've discussed this with your oncologist, you can back off in terms of how frequently you use the bisphosphonate. In terms of whether or not you should do a tooth extraction or not, our preference is, you know, while on a bisphosphonate, try and use conservative approaches. And I am sure Dr. Peterson can speak to this as well. We prefer root canals. We prefer conservative approaches as opposed to tooth extraction. If a tooth extraction is what is recommended, we ask that you stay off the bisphosphonate for at least 3 months, peri the tooth extraction time frame.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Dr. Peterson, do you want to comment?
I completely agree, and I would just add that the more we can prevent problems in association with the teeth and the gums and other conditions in the mouth, the better. And so if before the physician starts a patient on bisphosphonates, there is the opportunity for the dental team to perform the appropriate dental treatment, including a possible extraction if that's what's needed, it's much, much safer in that context rather than waiting 2 years, 3 years, even 4 years after the bisphosphonate's been started. But as Dr. Rajay rightly pointed out, if there's a tooth problem and we can conservatively treat that tooth problem, a root canal is much less invasive of the tissue and the bone than is a tooth extraction, then we would certainly work to be very, very conservative in our dental treatment.
Thank you. And Dr. Bensinger, did you?
No, I think the only other thing I'd like to point out is that one of the largest studies that have been conducted to date with bisphosphonates, the MRC9 trial, in that trial, their incidence of ONJ was quite low at only about 3.5%. And so it's just important to emphasize that I think the benefits of bisphosphonates far outweigh the potential negative aspects of the drugs, and so I think I would encourage the patients not to be afraid of getting those drugs because they're very helpful.
Excellent, thank you. And I think everyone on the call has this great benefit of hearing all of our speakers today representing different perspectives. It's so helpful to all of you to see this team in action, which is really so terrific, another benefit to the program, or an unanticipated benefit that you might get to see them all interacting with each other, which is so terrific. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from David R. Your question, please.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, okay. I have a question regarding Revlimid. Have you had experience in treating muscle cramps? There's also light chains involved with this as well, and sometimes some temporary blindness to the left or the right eye that would remain for a minute or two. And then I have one other question regarding bones.
Okay, thank you. Angie, do you want to ask the second question as well?
The other one has, have they ever used pulsed electromagnetic energy for the fractures, you know, for osteogenesis?
Okay, thank you. Dr. Roche, would you like to address those questions?
Sure. So we can talk about the Revlimid issue first. It's fairly common to see these side effects such as muscle cramping, and a lot of this is related to your body salts getting a little bit depleted, so that when your drugs like Revlimid or lenalidomide, your magnesium levels tend to be a little low. Sometimes your phosphorus levels seem to be low. So what generally works is, hydrate yourself well. I generally tell most of my patients to not just drink water, but drink kind of sports drinks, because sports drinks have electrolytes in them. So things like Gatorade, etc., is helpful. Muscle cramps is also sometimes an indication of neuropathy. Things like tonic water sometimes help. So it's essentially symptomatic treatment. Make sure your magnesium and phosphorus levels are replete, and your muscle cramping will certainly be less. In terms of electromagnetic therapy, is that what you'd ask, David, for bone disease?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, we typically have not used it, and I'm not aware of any prospective data or any data to support that for right now. As far as bone disease is concerned, treat the underlying myeloma, and use of bone strengthening agents such as the bisphosphonates is what's best used. In terms of promoting osteogenesis, that's a very interesting area, and we're really focusing on that area of research. We've actually identified certain proteins such as DKK1, which is produced by myeloma cells, and and inhibiting DKK1 should promote osteoblastogenesis. Similarly, we've identified other cytokines such as activin A, and I'd mentioned one of them in my presentation, which is ACE-011. So these are all in clinical trials, and these bone anabolic agents would be what we would be looking to for bone formation promotion.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Brenda S. Your question, please.
Yes. This is in regards to smoldering myeloma. I'm just wondering if one has been taking Fosamax for 8 years and has quit, should a smoldering myeloma patient go on IV bisphosphonates, and what is the role of calcium here?
Thank you for that question. Dr. Roger?
Yeah, sure. So that's a great question again, Brenda. As far as smoldering myeloma is concerned, if you have osteopenia or osteoporosis, the recommendation right now would be to treat it as if you had osteoporosis. So being on Fosamax would be fine, and when you're on Fosamax, you should be on calcium and vitamin D supplementation because it is just like any other bisphosphonate. The only difference being it's an oral bisphosphonate. Typically, smoldering myeloma does not have the classic, you know, bone lesions of myeloma. You don't have the lytic lesions. But you could have the osteoporosis, which is an age-related phenomenon, which is kind of unrelated to your smoldering myeloma. So the recommendation, as I pointed out, is treat it as if it were osteoporosis. There have been trials where we've used IV bisphosphonates in smoldering myeloma, the idea there being whether we would prevent the smoldering myeloma from becoming myeloma, and at least those data with IV bisphosphonates have to date not been positive. They've just helped with bone strengthening in osteoporotic doses. So I wouldn't necessarily go on to the monthly, once-a-month IV bisphosphonate the way we do it with myeloma patients.
Excellent. Well, I have to say this has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank our speakers. This has been quite the tour de force. I mean, an extraordinary call covering so many different topics. I want to thank all of our speakers. It's just wonderful. I want to thank all of you who queued up and asked such terrific questions. Your questions really enhanced our call and allowed us to elaborate on other points that were really very important. And I want to thank all of you who have been listening as well. And I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour program and that although we are soon going to be concluding this program, the services from Cancer Care for you, those will continue far after this program ends. And I just want to review that with you so that it's very clear to all of you. We don't want anyone on this call today to feel that you're alone in coping with myeloma, in coping with cancer. We want you to feel that you're part of a community of support. And that, as all these services from Cancer Care, they're free, and they're offered by 50 master's level trained oncology social workers. And we do a host of things, and I think Rick went over many of those with you, and Rick is an excellent, excellent example of an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. We also provide just an opportunity to talk with someone here at Cancer Care, to talk about some of your concerns. We offer practical assistance and financial assistance. We do have a copay foundation. We also do offer support groups, both on the telephone and online, which many of you will appreciate coming from all over the country and world. Being on a call, being on a support group that's on the telephone or online certainly simplifies your participation, does not require your travel, and really allows you to get a lot of support. We also have a number of materials and publications and fact sheets, as well as our Cancer Care Connect workshops, of which you're a part of today, and we have many more coming up. You all have a listing of all the future programs. They're also on the Cancer Care website as well. So most importantly, as we conclude today, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone. I want you to know that we're here for you, that you can simply call us at 1-800-813-HOPE or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. I want to thank you all for participating, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect.